You're listening to Killer Crimes. Hello, welcome back to another episode of Killer Crimes. I'm your host, Katya, and you're listening on WBCA LP 102.9 FM Boston, Boston's community radio station. The case we're talking about today is very well known. If you don't know his name, you certainly have heard of his MO or nickname. I thought this case was still pretty relevant because of the movie franchise It and the craze that happened a few years ago of people dressing up like clowns and scaring people. So if you haven't guessed yet, we're going to be talking about John Wayne Gacy, also known as the Killer Clown. I want to give you a little background information on John because I think it's very relevant. He was born in Chicago, Illinois in 1942. He had two sisters and his dad was an auto repair mechanic and a World War I veteran. As a child, John was overweight and non-athletic, which made developing a relationship with his father pretty hard, but he was still close to his sisters and mom. They all kind of stuck together because his father was an alcoholic and would physically abuse all of them. But even so, John's main goal in life was to make his father proud of him, even though he never really got his father's approval on anything. One of John's earliest memories was actually of his father beating him with a leather belt when he was 4 for accidentally messing up these car components his father had organized. His father also once hit him on the head with a broomstick and knocked him unconscious. John was also compared to his sisters a lot as being not as smart as them or worse than them in general. But even with all of this, John says that he never hated his father. And I don't say all this to make you pity him because trust me, he deserves no one's pity for what he ended up doing. But I think it's important to see how he developed as a child because it definitely played a role in who he became as an adult. In 1949, when John was only 7 years old, he was caught sexually fondling a little girl with one of his friends, which led to his father whipping him again. In that same year, John was actually molested by a family friend who was a contractor and would take John for rides in his truck and then fondle him. And John never told his father because he was afraid his father would blame it on him. And I think that was a pivotal moment in John's life, and that was kind of the drive for what he became. In middle school, John had a lot of health problems involving his heart. In the 4th grade, he even started blacking out and having seizures, and his condition was never diagnosed, but he spent almost 4 years in and out of the hospital, which led to his grades declining and him becoming even more isolated from everyone. When John was older, he worked as a mortuary attendant and would sleep on a cot behind the embalming room, which is so creepy, I don't know why. His day-to-day was basically observing the morticians embalming dead bodies, and one day he later admitted that he even climbed into a coffin of a dead teenage boy and started touching the body. He said no one caught him, but it did shock him a little, so he ended up calling his mother and asking if he could come home, and she said yes. When he moved back home, he enrolled in Northwestern Business College, and he even got married to Marilyn Myers. And while it seemed like he was getting his life together, one night one of his male coworkers invited him over and they ended up getting drunk and his coworker ended up performing oral sex on John. 2 years after this, John and Marilyn moved to Waterloo, Iowa, where he managed KFC restaurants. They also had 2 kids, a son and a daughter, which finally made John's father proud of him. John's father actually ended up apologizing to him as well when he saw John with his family and business. So while everything was looking perfect on the surface and John finally got his father's approval, he was still struggling with his own issues. He frequently cheated on his wife with prostitutes, and he even opened up a club in his basement and would hit on teenage boys he hired to work there, which I don't really know how you can open up a club in your basement and not look suspicious and only have teenage boys attend. But John never sexually assaulted anyone until 1967. The boy was 15-year-old Donald Voorhees. John lured Donald into his house by saying he would show him porn that he had, and once Donald was inside, John got him drunk and forced him to perform oral sex on him. In the following months, John would use this trick on several other boys, and none of them would really come forward. In one instance, John even made a boy have sex with his wife and then blackmailed him into performing oral sex on him. John would also tell the boys that he was commissioned with conducting homosexual experiments for scientific research and then would pay them $50. 1 year after his assault, Donald actually told his father what John did to him, and he was arrested and charged with oral sodomy and the attempted assault of another boy, Edward Lynch. Of course, John denied all the charges and demanded that he take a polygraph test. And we all know polygraph tests aren't really accurate, but John took the test and it indicated that he was nervous when answering questions related to the charges, which didn't really help him because on May 10th of that year, John was indicted. In August of that year, John somehow persuaded 18-year-old Russell Schroeder to physically assault Donald so he would be scared to testify against him in the upcoming trial. And he did all of this from prison. Russell agreed for some reason, and he lured Donald to a secluded spot, sprayed him with mace, and then beat him while warning him not to testify. Donald obviously reported the assault to the police, and Russell was arrested too. When Russell was questioned, he said that John told him to assault Donald, and John was additionally charged with hiring Russell to assault Donald. In September, John was ordered to undergo a psychiatric evaluation, and according to two different doctors, John was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder and was unlikely to benefit from any therapy or medical treatment. They also said he was mentally competent to stand trial. John pleaded guilty to the sexual assault on Donald, which is what his attorney advised, but not guilty to every other boy who came forward. But during his trial, John said that Donald was the one who offered oral sex and that he went along with it out of curiosity. John was then convicted to 10 years in jail, which led his wife to divorce him and gain custody of their kids. And that was the last time John would ever see Marilyn and their two kids. Now, in prison, John actually gained the reputation of a model prisoner. Within months, he was promoted to head cook, he supervised projects, and he somehow got the prison to increase the inmates' daily pay. He applied for parole but was denied, so he completed 16 high school courses and earned his diploma to look better for the second hearing later on. In this second hearing, his parole was actually granted with 12 months probation after he served only 18 months of his 10-year sentence. That is just disgusting. I don't care how well he was doing in prison. Why do you have a sentence if you're not going to follow it? He literally assaulted so many boys. 1 year after his release, John was charged again with assaulting a teenage boy. The boy said that John lured him into his car and drove him home, where he then attempted to rape him. However, this case was actually dismissed because the boy didn't appear in court. Now, obviously, this whole situation violated John's parole, but somehow, the Iowa Board of Parole didn't hear about this incident, and 8 months later, John's parole ended. So by the time they heard about this accused rape, John's parole was over, so they really couldn't arrest him again. Okay, two things. I understand it must be incredibly hard to testify against someone who tried to assault you, and there's no way he could have known what John would end up doing, but the fact that if John was indicted again, he wouldn't have been able to hurt anyone else just makes me so angry. But I'm far more angry at the parole board because he would have been locked up again just for being arrested. Do your job. Anyway, after all of this, John bought a house and got engaged to another woman named Carol Hoff. 1 week before the wedding, John was arrested and charged again with aggravated battery and reckless conduct after a teenager named Jackie D told police that John was impersonating a police officer when he lured him into his car and forced him to perform oral sex. But these charges were also dropped after Jackie tried to blackmail John into paying him money in exchange for him dropping the charges. So once again, John was free. After getting married, John switched careers and started his own construction business. In 1973, John took a teenage employee to Florida to view a property, and when they got to Florida, John raped the teenage boy in their hotel room. I don't know why any parent would let their teenaged son go to Florida with their boss, but I guess I'm not a parent. When they returned from the trip, the teenager went to John's house and beat him until his wife came outside to stop them. John told his wife it was just because John refused to pay him for his poor work, but other than that, the incident was never reported. A couple years later, John discovered a clown club called the Jolly Joker, where people would perform at fundraising events and parades, and sometimes to hospitalized children. John joined the club and created his own characters called Pogo the Clown and Patchy the Clown. He designed his own costumes, wore clown makeup, and would perform at local parties and hospitals. And this is why he had the nickname of Killer Clown. I don't think he actually killed people dressed up like a clown, which is what I thought before researching, but he just had a fascination with clowns, which you'll also see later. So during the same year with all the clown stuff going on, John told his wife that he was bisexual. And his wife said that after this, she would see John bring teenage boys into the garage. She found gay pornography, and she also found wallets and identification cards of boys inside of the house. When she confronted him about all of this, he couldn't give her any answers, so she ended up divorcing him. Now let's get into John Gacy's first known murder, because this is what he says is his first murder, but you can't really believe him. On January 2nd, 1972, John picked up 16-year-old Timothy McCoy from the bus terminal. He took Timothy on a sightseeing tour of Chicago, then drove him to his own home, saying that the next day he would drive Timothy back to the bus station. John says that he woke up the following morning to Timothy standing in his bedroom doorway holding a knife. When John got up and tried to disarm him, Timothy raised his arms in surrender, which made him accidentally cut John's arm, and he actually had a scar on his arm from this. Then John grabbed the knife and banged Timothy's head against the wall and kicked him. Timothy fought back, but John then wrestled him to the ground and stabbed him multiple times in the chest. John said he then went to the kitchen and saw there was a whole breakfast set up for two, and he realized that Timothy probably used the knife to make the breakfast and forgot he was holding it when he went to wake up John. So in the future, after everything, after he got caught, he told the police that this was his first murder. He did it in self-defense because he thought Timothy was trying to hurt him, but then realized that Timothy was trying to do something nice for him just to make breakfast to say thank you for giving me a ride to and from the bus station, which... my God. After the murder, John buried Timothy in his crawl space and then covered it with a layer of cement. And in later interviews, John also said that he had an orgasm while he killed Timothy. And that's when he realized that killing was the ultimate thrill. And I don't even need to say anything about that. The second murder happened 2 years later. John said that he lured another teenager to his house and strangled him, and then stuffed his body in his closet before burying him in his backyard. 3 years after this, he started hiring more teenage boys to work on his construction sites, and one of the boys he hired was 15-year-old Anthony Antonucci. One night, John went to Anthony's house when he was alone and wrestled him to the ground before handcuffing Anthony's hands behind his back. One of the handcuffs was loose, so Anthony actually got his arm free when John left the room, and when John returned, Anthony attacked him, got the key to his handcuffs, and cuffed John's hands behind his back. John said he promised to leave the house if Anthony removed the handcuffs, and Anthony actually agreed and let him go. That is bizarre to me. Nothing was ever reported. This whole incident just happened, and Anthony just still worked at the construction site. 1 week after all this happened, another one of John's employees, 18-year-old John Bukovich, disappeared. John lured the missing boy to his house and put him in handcuffs before strangling him to death and burying him under the concrete floor of his garage. John Bukovich's car was later found in an abandoned parking lot with his wallet inside. The parents begged police to investigate John Wayne Gacy as a suspect because they knew he was the boss of the construction site and they've heard stories, but the police never investigated him. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I'll be telling you more about John Wayne Gacy's murders. You're listening to Killer Crimes on WBCALP 102.9 Boston, Boston's community radio station. Stay tuned.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please, help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay.
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, eight kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
For Women's History Month, BNN and WBCA are paying homage to all the women who have created history. Maria Mitchell, astronomer, librarian, naturalist, and educator. Mitchell was the first internationally known woman to work as both a professional astronomer and a professor of astronomy. In 1847, she discovered a comet that was later known as Miss Mitchell's Comet in her honor. Women's History Month, celebrating the leadership, achievements, courage, and the strength of women.
Hello, welcome back to Killer Crimes. I'm your host, Katya, and you're listening on WBCALP 102.9 FM Boston, Boston's community radio station. So John Wayne Gacy soon developed an MO because he knew it was working. He would get the boys drunk, handcuff them, and then strangle them to death. Between the years of 1976 and 1978, John went on a murder spree. And the thing we notice with most serial killers is that they wait a while in between their victims. But John Gacy, just his timeline was so fast, and you'll see what I mean. He killed 18-year-old Daryl Sampson, then 15-year-old Randall Reffitt 5 weeks later, then 14-year-old Samuel Stapleton just hours later. And he would bury all of these victims in his crawl space. He killed 17-year-old Michael Bonin, 16-year-old William Carroll 10 days later, and many more boys who the police weren't even able to identify to this day. In the same time period, John hired 18-year-old David Cram, and for some reason, a month later, David actually moved into John's house. The day after the move, John handcuffed David and was planning to rape him. However, David was actually in the army, so he fought back and freed himself. But he didn't move out, which I will never understand. 1 month later, John went to David's bedroom and tried to assault him again, but David fought him off again. And I guess he finally got the hint after the second incident because David finally moved out, but still worked for him at the construction company, which is insane. And he also never reported this to the police. After this incident, John abducted two teenagers, Kenneth Parker and Michael Marino, strangled them, then buried them in that crawl space too. 2 days later, he strangled 19-year-old William Bundy. It baffles me how no one noticed that all of John's employees were just going missing because he was getting all these teenage boys to work for the construction company so he could murder them. But did no one notice that all these new employees were slowly disappearing? 2 months later, he murdered 17-year-old Gregory Godzik, who had only been working at the construction company for 3 weeks. A month after this, John lured 19-year-old John Sizek to his house by telling him he wanted to buy a Plymouth satellite that John Sizek was selling. And remember, these are just the boys that were identified and found, and only a few from 1976. There were many more. In 1977, John killed 21-year-old Russell Nelson, 16-year-old Robert Winch, 20-year-old Tom Bowling, 19-year-old David Talsma, just to name a few. And also that year, John abducted a 19-year-old student named Robert Donnelly at gunpoint. He drove him back to his house, raped him, and tortured him for hours. But the crazy thing is, John didn't end up killing Robert. He drove Robert back to his work and let him go. And I kind of thought that John wanted to get caught so he could stop hurting people because that's actually what some killers do. But when Robert reported the assault, John was questioned and he insisted that everything was consensual. And the police actually ended up believing John and letting him go. That makes absolutely no sense to me. Robert literally detailed the torture and rape that he went through and the police just didn't believe him. A month later, John killed 19-year-old William Kindred, and that was the final victim that John could fit in his crawl space. That's how many people he killed. In 1978, John started disposing new bodies in the Des Plaines River. One night, he abducted 26-year-old Jeffrey Rignall, chloroformed him, and then took him to his house where he raped and tortured him. John then dumped him in a park, but he was actually still alive. He was just unconscious. So Jeffrey ended up reporting the assault. And again, police didn't investigate. By this point, so many men came forward against this man. And you're telling me the police just did not care? When like 10 men say that someone raped and tortured them, you don't think to look into it at all? On December 11th, 1978, a 15-year-old boy named Robert Peist was supposed to get picked up by his mother after his shift at Nissan Pharmacy. But Robert told his mother that first he wanted to talk to a construction man about a potential job. But Robert never met up with his mother, so she gathered her family and they all looked for him. When they couldn't find him, they reported Robert as a missing person to the police. There was a lieutenant on the police force who had a son in the same high school as Robert, so he did a very in-depth investigation and he actually learned that John's company remodeled Nissan Pharmacy recently and that John was the man Robert spoke to about the contracting job. John was asked to come in for questioning that night, but he never showed up. And what police didn't know was while they were waiting for him at the station, John was dumping Robert's body in the Des Plaines River. On December 13th at 3:20 a.m., John went to the police station and asked to speak to the lieutenant. The lieutenant asked for the key to John's house because he had a warrant to search his house, and John gave him the keys willingly. And this is what makes me confused, because on one hand, I really think that he wanted to get caught and he wanted to stop because he knew it was a sickness. But on the other hand, he might have been selfish and not wanted to stop because of other things that we're going to talk about later. When the police searched John's house, they found a receipt for a roll of film that was being processed and developed. But Robert's family said that the receipt actually belonged to Robert's friend. Robert had agreed to develop a roll of film for his friend, so the police were certain that Robert was in John's house at some point. On December 15th, police put John on a 24-hour surveillance watch while also continuing to search his house. And when searching, they found a high school ring that belonged to John Sizek, one of his victims from 2 years prior. On December 19th, John invited two police officers over for breakfast, which I guess he was trying to front that he had nothing to hide. But at this point, they had already found the receipt and the ring. See, I don't know if he's trying to get caught or he's trying to front that he's innocent. The officers said that the second they stepped into John's house, they smelled death and they saw disturbing artwork of clowns on the wall. On December 20th, 1978, the police learned of John's previous record involving the sodomy and battery charges in 1968. And I don't know why it took them this long to figure out. This happened 10 years ago. It's in the police records. It took them this long to figure out he has a history of this. I don't know what was happening with these policemen, but wow. But the crazy thing is that a day after this, John was actually arrested, but he was arrested because a policeman saw him hand a package of marijuana to a gas station clerk. That's why he was arrested. While he was in custody, the police obtained another search warrant for his house. And while they were there, the police were convinced that John was holding Robert captive underneath the floor of his home. So they thought he was actually alive. John denied these claims, and technically he wasn't lying because Robert's body was in the Des Plaines River. It wasn't underneath the crawl space. What he told them was he once had to kill a man in self-defense and bury him underneath the floor, referring to his first victim, Timothy. And then John actually led the police to the spot above the floor and marked exactly where Timothy's body was buried. And while John was showing the police where the spot was, they actually saw the trap door to the crawl space. So they investigated it and they found the body parts of three different boys. On December 22nd, John confessed to more murders. He told the police that he killed 33 boys after having sexual relations with them. But a weird thing about his confession was that when he was admitting to these murders, he spoke only in the third person, saying John killed them or even Jack killed them. I don't know why he was referring to himself as Jack, but it was all third person. Then John drew diagrams of where all the bodies were located and he named six of his victims. He then said he buried 27 of the victims on his property. And when police looked, they actually found 29 bodies. 29 bodies just on his property. John then said five bodies were thrown in the Des Plaines River, but police were only able to find four of them. He was charged with Robert's murder, even though Robert's body was not found, but obviously it was the fifth body. And police were finding IDs, wallets, personal belongings of so many boys in John's house. On January 4th, 1979, police found Robert Peist's jacket in John's home, and I think that really sealed the deal. If the 29 bodies didn't already. On January 8th, 1979, John Wayne Gacy was charged with the murder of seven young men, which I don't understand because they found 29 bodies in his house alone and then four more in the river. But what's even crazier than that is that after all of this, John pled not guilty. Not guilty. After drawing a diagram of where he hid all the bodies, after naming his victims, after 29 literal bodies were found in his house. He pled not guilty. His trial began on February 6, 1980, and after 2 weeks, it only took the jury 2 hours to decide that John Gacy was guilty. John was sentenced to death on May 10th by lethal injection, and even though John was dead, his victims' cases lived on. In 2015, 11 cold cases were solved by Detective Moran, which actually took them off the list of John Wayne Gacy's murdered victims. Because police really only knew about 33 of his victims, and John confessed to killing 45 people. So police were attributing any young boy's death to John. There are still unidentified victims that were found in the crawl space as well. In 1984, a Missing Child Recovery Act was initiated, inspired by the Gacy murders. And this act basically removed the rule that police had to wait 72 hours before investigating a missing child, which is amazing. I know this was a lot of information thrown at you, but I hope it gave you a concise overview of John Wayne Gacy, because even though I had heard about him before, I didn't know that all of this happened. If you're listening on a podcast platform, you can leave me a comment telling me what you think of this whole case. Thank you guys for tuning in on WBCA LP 102.9 FM Boston. I'm your host Katya, and this is Killer Crimes. I'll see you guys next time. Bye. Maybe it's in the color where I left my lover. What an expensive thing. My V is for